What up, and welcome to the motherfucking Soulcast. This podcast is being conducted in my barn because my studio is still not 100% up and running, so I'm recording it on my iPhone. If it sounds weird, that's why. But actually, these little FBI, NSA monitoring devices have crystal clear quality, so that's great. This is going to be, kind of an experimental episode. Originally, this was going to be a Patreon exclusive Q&A episode, but I had a real good time making this, and I felt like it was good enough to release as a regular podcast to the public. Maybe I'll do more stuff like this. It's fun taking questions and speaking on subjects. I'd love to hear from people out there. If you are feeling this, give me a shout. Let me know what you think about it. Hit me up on Twitter at MC Soul, or find me on Instagram, or should I say Fedstagram, at Young Soul, or just pop me an email at soul, S-O-L-E, at soul1.org. And I'm really trying to get more people on the Patreon. So if you enjoy this project, if you enjoy this podcast, please consider becoming a monthly sustainer for as little as a dollar. And if nothing else, that helps. That helps bypass social media, but most importantly, sort of creates a community and allows for this work to continue to grow and be more sustainable. So again, if you enjoy this podcast, if you want to help it to grow, feel free, become a monthly sustainer at patreon.com/SOLEONE. Like I said, I had a blast doing this interview. I rambled a bit, but I also just kind of let some shit fly, deleted some stuff because sometimes some things don't need to be said, put it that way. But I hope you enjoy this podcast, and if you want to hear more podcasts like this, or if you have more subjects or topics you'd like to hear me speak on future episodes, pop me an email, hit me on the gram, or holla on Twitter. All right. What up? It's Big Soul reporting live from Holland Commune East in southern Maine, aka Holland Farms. And this is another one of those From Bodily Humans to the Barricades Patreon exclusive podcasts. And today I'm just kind of taking listener questions. Now, before I start with the questions, I just wanted to thank everyone who has been supporting my work through Patreon. It would have been a huge challenge to try to pull off what we just pulled off without this, monthly paycheck. So I just want to send a sincere, heartfelt thank you to everyone who's been riding with me through the ups and downs, to the creation of podcasts, the creation of music. I feel like 2018 for me has been sort of the year the dog ate my homework. I've got so many things I'd wanted to do and tried to do, and I just didn't have the time. So hopefully now that I'm out here, more stabilized, quiet life, with the support of family, we'll be able to accomplish more, but we'll see how that goes. Some things are going to have to change. One of the main things I'm doing is I'm ending the record label, Black Box Tapes, which I've been sort of on the fence about doing, but kind of wanting to do for a while, and I need to pull the Band-Aid off because I got too many irons in the fire, and I want to focus on the things that really inspire me, not the things that I feel obligated to do out of some weird sense of whatever. Another thing, when I use the word commune, it's in some ways sort of sarcastic. I don't know if a family on a homestead can qualify as a commune. It was kind of a joke that I started back in Denver. I'd always just refer to my house as the Holland Commune as kind of like a way to, prioritize my collective, aka my family. But, you know, now it's starting to look more and more like a commune. It's crazy. You know, we are on this farm now, and it is just incredible. It's a huge cultural shift for us. You know, when I look in my yard, it's incredible. Like our backyard is forest, and then it goes all the way to the Androscoggin River, which is this beautiful wide river that flows into the ocean. And so it's just, it's like a dream. And I wouldn't have been able to do it without Patreon and without the support of people who fuck with my art. So thank you. The other thing I wanted, I just wanted to say that, I feel like us doing this and us pulling this off is really a testament to sticking to your guns and not giving a fuck. You know, we got back in 2013, right before real estate blew up in Denver. We managed to qualify for a home loan to buy a house in downtown Denver. And, you know, all we did was live there. And while we lived there, the property value rose so quickly that we were basically able to use the equity from our house to straight up buy this farm with cash. Now, I understand the arguments against private property and speculative stuff and how using your house as like a credit card crashed the economy in 2018. You know, all that is true, but sometimes, you know, you got to just make the system work for you and to suit the shit you want out of life. And, you know, after all is said and done, we're not going to have a fucking mortgage in a year. And that is insane. So, yeah, I'm not sure what the lesson is there, but I feel like, bottom line, sometimes you just got to roll the dice really fucking hard and just say fuck it, because life is too short. And, you know, I know there's a lot of people who, you know, see this shit and they think it's some petty bourgeois shit, and maybe to some people it is, but it's like, I've been fucking poor my whole life, my whole adult life, and I ain't got no complaints about it. And I used what I had to get what I wanted, and I would encourage everyone to do the same. I mean, again, I'm 40 years old. It took a while to get here, but, and there's a whole lot of work ahead of us. I mean, we moved into this house, the furnace had exploded, all the pipes had burst, the roof was fucked up, no one had lived here for 2 years, this place was a foreclosure, and so we got it super, super cheap. But we had to, you know, call in a lot of favors from plumbers in our family, you know, my mom's boyfriend. I mean, we put a lot of fucking work into this house, and there's still a ton of work left to do. So, like, right now, I'm recording this in the downstairs of this barn that we have. We don't know what we're going to do with this barn. We're probably going to build little art studios, music studios for ourselves. But again, all that shit takes time. And so right now I'm just hanging out in here because my son is sick, and it's all my fault probably, because we were foraging blueberries and raspberries, and I think, well, we should have washed the blueberries first, and so I think he got sick from it. And again, we're not sure, but I'd bet my money on that. All right, so that's the intro. That's all I got to say about that. You know, I say this all the time, but if you're in New England doing radical shit, I wanna meet more folks out here who are doing this shit, who are anarchists, radicals, whatever, permaculturists, people who are just doing shit differently. Hit me up. All right. So, oh yeah, one last thing. I didn't put out a new podcast this month because I just got internet yesterday, and it was just crazy. We closed on this house July 10th, and we've just been busting our ass just trying to get this place livable, painting and just getting rid of, like, fucking disgusting floors, rotting shit. But now we're pretty much up and running. Still got some more work to do, that's for sure. But at least I can get some shit done. So I got a lot of podcasts lined up for the next month or two. cool stuff. I'm excited about conversations that I'm going to be having with folks. One of the interviews I'm very excited about is with Inhabit Global. You should check out their book. It's called Instructions for Autonomy, and it seems like these people are pretty much inspired by a lot of the sort of Invisible Committee Tycoon stuff that I'm really into, sort of taking a North American approach to it, and I think that's hella necessary. So I would encourage people to check out that project. I'll be interviewing them in the next couple weeks, so if you have questions for them, let me know. I'm also going to be interviewing Margaret Killjoy. Margaret Killjoy is a science fiction writer, anarchist, and musician, and I'm super pumped on that because Margaret is also living in an intentional community, and so I want to sort of have a conversation about that and dystopias. Other interview requests I have out, and I haven't quite locked down the schedule yet, but doing a bunch of them over the next couple months. Probably some more rappers because I'm trying to wrap up this book for PM Press. Hopefully they haven't revoked their offer. I haven't signed the contract yet because I've just been fucking busy. All right, now to the questions. What's the wildlife up there? I just recently moved out to the wilderness and I've been running into bears. It's fucking nuts. Well, thankfully, I have not seen any bears. I don't think there are many bears out here. However, and I'm living in Brunswick. I mean, it's not a big fucking secret. Brunswick is a little college town. So where I live, I have not seen any bears. Because of the proximity to the river, there was just tons and tons and tons of birds. Chickadees, cardinals, there's this weird little kingfisher kind of bird that lives under our barn, and that just cracks me up. It was funny, my wife and our son was hanging out in our front yard the other day, and she freaked out because like a snake slithered over her foot. And so we have like a den of garter snakes in our front yard. There's tree frogs everywhere. And all this is very novel. I've been living in the desert for the last 15 years. And yes, Denver is a desert. I just love just seeing frogs and all that shit. They're behind my house. They hunt deer and turkey in the fall. So apparently there's wild turkeys everywhere, which I'm fucking pumped about. We have not had any problems with ticks so far, knock on wood. No ticks. We've been rushing through the woods, rolling around in the grass. And I think that has to do with the amount of birds in the area, but we're going to probably get some chickens. I wanted to get guinea hens, but everyone is telling me how fucking aggressive they are. So we're probably going to get chickens to like free roam on our property and take care of the ticks for us. But the one thing that really blew my mind is when I hiked to the Androscoggin River for the first time, I just saw a bald eagle flying by, and, you know, fuck America, fuck all that shit. But from what I understand, Native Americans also saw, I should say indigenous peoples saw bald eagles as a, you know, really special animal. And I mean, it's a really cool looking bird. I mean, it's a fucking big ass bird. And I saw a bald eagle fly over my house the other day. So I've seen a bald eagle 3 times in my life. 2 of those times were in the last month. So, you know, there's a lot of shit like that out here. Woodchucks. Hopefully we don't have fucking mice here. I will fucking kill someone. Definitely, it's wet here, so there's fucking bugs. Hella bugs. I was really blown away. I saw stag beetles in my mom's yard, and she's like, oh, that's just a June bug. And I'm like, that is not a fucking June bug. Stag beetles are... I grew up looking at bugs. We never saw those when I was a kid. But now they're, you know, they're found here, and that has to do with global warming. Okay, here's another question. It would be so interesting to have you interview Nikola Danilov and have a discussion around anarchism and technology. He's open-minded, now vegan, futurist, and podcaster who has an interesting journey. He's interviewed many high-level people around the fields of technology and the singularity, among which even some friends of us like Noam Chomsky and Pete Singer. Not a quick, easy project, but I'd love to see your opinions and perspectives collide. So they sent a link to the Singularity Live blog, and just basically says, for humanity, for generations, humanity stared at the vastness of the oceans and wondered what if. Today, having explored the curves of the Earth, we now stare at endless stars and wonder what if. Our technology has brought us to the make or break moment in human history. We can either grow complacent and go extinct like the dinosaurs, or spread throughout the cosmos as Carl Sagan dreamed of. What if your toothbrush becomes smarter than you? What happens to your business, to your country, to your planet and yourself, et cetera, et cetera. So I went through and I read a little bit of this stuff. You know, I like that this person is sort of critically analyzing technology, you know, but I feel like calling it the singularity, you know, just my instant gut criticism is sort of, you know, seems like it's sort of trying to be an intervention within the, you know, techno fetishism that's happening. And I mean, just from that paragraph from his book, we can either grow complacent and go extinct or spread throughout the cosmos. You know, I guess it would be interesting to listen to the podcast. Sounds pretty nuanced, but just that statement, going complacent or go extinct, you know, there are a lot of people who would argue that, like, you know, there's another way, which is not to, you know, head straight for space and to fix things here on Earth. Again, I'd need to read more and look more into this person's work. It's definitely piqued my interest, but I think that, you know, relying on technology and talking about going to space, it sounds great. I mean, I love science fiction, but I don't, you know, it's who's leading the charge into space. It's people like Elon Musk, Elon Musk is a union buster. He supports right wing, political action committees. You know, it's Jeff Bezos, someone who's like destroying the working class. So when we look at who is leading the charge into space, it makes me just want to pump the fucking brakes on all that talk, because the people who are going to take us to space there's just no way they're going to be altruistic about it. And the same thing for all this technology, all this disruptive shit. Like, people just, you know, Jeff Bezos calls that shit his winnings, his money, his winnings. And it's not fucking winnings. Like, you fucking are destroying so many things all at once, and it's all happening so fast. And I feel like we don't need to race towards the singularity. We need to pump the fucking brakes on that shit and come up with sensible ways to incorporate technology into our lives that don't. I feel like right now I'm in a place where technology controls me. Algorithms, digital means of whatever. You know, if I don't put out a podcast every 2 weeks, it shows up differently in your podcast app. And so these algorithms want us to work for them. And it you know, and I don't give a fuck. I'm pumping the brakes on that shit. Like, I'm not here to pump out content to please algorithms. I'm here to create thoughtful shit that is intentional. I'm not out here trying to, like, again, that's why this podcast, I'm not going to do a public thing with it, because I don't want, like, this podcast in particular, where I'm like talking about my own shit. Like, I don't want to be the subject of my podcast. Like, there's a lot of podcasts where it's just like, oh, here's this person's personality, and I'm just going to be myself, and you're going to listen. And, you know, maybe I could do that, but that's just not how, I just don't believe in that shit. So yeah, we'll see. I want to check out more of this guy's work, because I don't want to jump to conclusions based off, like, reading a few things. Okay. What are your original reasons for becoming a vegetarian and vegan? What is your perspective now? My original reasons were I read Charlotte's Web and, loved that book. And then I found out how all my favorite meat was made, whether it's sausage, hot dogs, beef jerkies, etc. These were all my favorite things to eat, like Slim Jims. And then I learned, my fifth grade teacher told me all that shit is made by scraping up what's left on the floor of the factory and grinding it up. And so when I found that out, it just like really grossed me out. And then I was just a weird kid. Like, I'd be eating chicken and I would pick all the veins out of my chicken because it just fucking grossed me out. And then one day my dad was eating like a pig at the dinner table. He really ate loud, like, and that shit just fucking bothers me. And I would like plug my ear at the dinner table. And then one day I just fucking snapped at him when I was like fifth grade and like started cussing at him. And my parents sent me downstairs without dinner. And so when I was down there, they came down and were like, "What was that about?" And then just in that moment, I made up, "Don't you know I'm a vegetarian now?" And that was literally it. And then I just stuck to it. So I don't know what that says. And I never really wanted to be vegan. When me and Yasmin got together, maybe when I, when I was 23 or 24, 20, I don't know, 23, she moved in with me after about a year, and she wanted, her and her sister had just gone vegan, and so I just thought I would try it with her. And so we like learned how to make like nut cheeses and just sort of got into that, and we liked it. And then as soon as she like went back to school that fall, I went out and got some goat cheese pizza at Arizmendi's in Oakland, which is like some of the best, coolest pizza you can ever have. It's a co-op, collectively owned. Check it out if you're ever out there. But so I went and got like a goat cheese, I think it was like goat cheese, apricot, walnut, like, you know, gourmet, just dope pizza. And when I got that, I just was grossed out. It didn't agree with me. So after that, I decided I didn't want to be vegetarian. I wanted to be vegan because I realized that all the phlegm and issues I have with like my throat and coughing up all the time when I'm recording, like I can just breathe better if I don't eat cheese. So part of it is health. When I became vegetarian, I was told that I was shaving years off my life because I wasn't going to get enough protein. And that was back in the 90s when people didn't really, now people go vegan for health reasons. Go figure. So what are my thoughts on it now? I have mixed feelings about veganism in general and vegan culture and vegan activism. There are some people who say veganism is hyper-privileged. I think that's lazy, to be honest. Once you get in the practice of soaking beans and you learn how to cook vegan, it's actually cheaper, it's healthier. Yes, it does take a little more time for preparation, but once you learn how to plan ahead, and it really depends on where you are. Like if you're in Denver, you can go to King Supers or places like that and get really cheap organic beans, organic produce. In places like where I am here in Maine, it makes no fucking sense, but organic vegan food is like 50 to 75% more than I'm used to paying. And that like really bothers me. But so I've just gone back to soaking beans, putting a little more effort into making things rather than like doing the kind of lazy shopping I was doing in the last year, which is fine. But again, it really has to do with adapting to where you're at. And again, like a lot of the best food from all around the world, whether it's Indian food, chana masala or good, there's so like African food from Latin America. I mean, so much of that shit is just corn and beans and rice and vegetables, and it's so fucking good. And there's so much awesome shit that you can do and cook vegan. But from a political standpoint, my feelings about it are kind of mixed. Like, first of all, I fucking hate vegans who preach. I fucking hate vegans who, who don't have any sort of class consciousness, and they go around and they'll see somebody eating a hamburger and yell at them without bothering to understand why somebody would eat fast food. You can get a burger for $2 and just go up and get it. Whereas, you know, you're not going to get a sandwich, a vegan sandwich, for under $10 anywhere in the fucking... anywhere. Like, there are real reasons why a lot of people are not vegan.
Not a fan of vegans who
go around, like, sharing images of animals being tortured online. I don't think that's an effective way to galvanize people any more than showing pictures of mutilated, Iraqi children or Afghani children. Like, that shit doesn't, for whatever reason, that just doesn't move people. It should, but at this point, everyone is so desensitized. Like, you see an image like that, and then bam, you're used to it. That's how I feel. That's what I think. It normalizes things. Which reminds me of the new Boots Riley movie. Sorry to bother you. Holy fuck. I was almost in tears at the end of that movie. It was so fucking good. Everyone should go see it. And also, like, really getting into, like, ecology and, you know, quote-unquote primitivism and knowing people like that. You know, I've never had a problem with people who hunt. I've never had a problem with how indigenous people live. I've never had a problem with, you know, my sister was vegan for years, but now she has goat milk. She has goats. She has chicken. She eats eggs. You know, and then, like, she hadn't eaten meat, but then one day, like, a duck was being an asshole and was raping other ducks, so she killed it and ate it. I couldn't do that, but I respect that on a lot of levels. You know, I feel like my biggest issue with veganism is alienation. The alienation of going into a store and getting processed meat in styrofoam wrapped in plastic, and then so much of that meat goes bad, and it's just a waste. It's a waste of life. You know, I mean, of course animals are, they're capable of empathy, love, compassion. They are, you know, I have no interest in killing animals, none, but I also recognize that we're at the top of the food chain, and if shit hit the fan, I might reimagine that. Like, if we're living in a different sort of world where, you know, these creature comforts I have vanished, and because right now, trying to homestead on some vegan shit, like, I can barely grow enough beans to last me for 3 meals. Like, I've had 2 or 3 beds of beans, and I could barely get enough beans for 3 meals. And I'm talking 6-foot-tall bean plants. So, you know, one of my big challenges out here is trying to figure out a vegan approach to farming. I think that will involve hazelnuts. It'll involve cultivation of acorns, trying to utilize the protein from acorns, walnuts, and Chinese kinds of chestnuts, which are immune to the blight that wiped out all the chestnut trees. Because for years, the hundreds and maybe thousands of years, the people of North America lived off chestnuts as a main staple crop, not entirely, but
and yeah, I'm punching in again because as I was listening to this, I realized I didn't make my point as concisely as I wanted to. I think the main point and distinction I want to draw here is the difference between animal rights and veganism. Veganism does not lead to animal rights, and vegan activism does not necessarily lead to animal rights. Nor does, like, writing your senators, the things that lead to that forward the cause of animal rights and, most importantly, animal liberation, are direct action. And that's more what I am in favor of than people going around making a big deal about what people are eating. Because the problem here are the factories, the factory farm, the culture, just mass exploitation and death of animals, and individuals and their shopping choices are not really the determinant factor in these things. Sure, if you get everyone in the world to stop eating meat, whatever, they're still going to be eating dogs in China. So, you know, again, it's not it's not the main focus of my activism. It's a big part of my life, veganism and animal rights, but I'm just turned off by a lot of the shit that I see in that world outside of people who are actually fighting for animal rights.
So, yeah, and just in general, you know, I've always, you know, been more interested in organizing against the police, in organizing against the state, in organizing for what I see as a revolutionary potential, whereas, like, veganism, in a lot of sense, just feels like comes off as a lifestyle choice. You know, I'm always down. I've done benefits, and I'm always down to especially talk to animal liberation organizers, like people who are engaged in sabotage, people who engage in, like, freeing animals. You know, I'm always down to support political prisoners who have come up against that stuff. You know, like, I interviewed Josh Harper a while ago. If you want to, I thought that was a great interview. But yeah, and so for our place, you know, we are probably going to get chickens and, you know, keep them mainly to control the ticks, but they're going to make eggs and, you know, we'll feed them to our dog or dogs if we get more dogs. God, we're so devastated from the death of our Yorkie. From our dogs or, and for our son, and other kids if we have more, because I feel like, you know, the fatty omega B12 kind of shit, like, a lot of that stuff is hard to get in a vegan diet, and so we're probably gonna, I mean, we feed him eggs, and if we're growing our own eggs, I mean, I'm repulsed by the idea right now, but it seems stupid to have that and not eat it, so it'll be interesting to see if, after having chickens for a while, if we can eat eggs. I'm, like, disgusted when I think about eating eggs, and I probably don't think I will, but I'm open to it, I guess, if that makes sense. So yeah, I mean, that's, in general, I like vegan, I just can't fuck with veganism that doesn't have a class consciousness or intersectionality. It's one of these things that's just comes off and is hyper privileged, and that's got to change. So that's one of the, I mean, one of the things we're not really sure what we're going to be doing here, but I wouldn't be surprised if we opened some kind of vegan food thing, but we'll see. Oh, here we go. Here's another question. Do you plan on mostly feeding your family from your new farm / commune? How long until your farm is fully operational, and any plans for food that you have never grown? Okay. So, do I plan on? Yes. You know, again, we're trying to see what this place is like, and there's actually a ton of work that goes into it. Much of it is brush and forest. Some of it seems like wetlands. There's a little stream. There's a little pond. There's hill. There's like a hill and an incline, which is like a great thing for permaculture approach to gardens. And there's a bunch of beds on the left. It's 1.3 acres, which isn't a ton of space. It's a lot. It's fucking, you know, 10, 15 times what I've ever had to grow on. But it's not like, you know, it's not endless. But it's a really manageable thing for us. So my immediate goals, yes, are to feed our family. That's why I just, like, took over some of the annual beds that were overgrown and just threw some vegetables in there, and I'm gonna do cold frames on them because organic produce is so expensive out here that, I'd rather just grow it myself. And I like it. I want to learn what it's like growing at sea level because it's very different. Everything is more lush here. It's, you know, it's cooler. It's not fucking, you know, 100 degrees all the time. So yeah, we're going to be growing a lot of that stuff. But mostly to start, but no, I have plans of, we're going to do something with this. I'm not sure what might be. We might open a little restaurant. We might, I think what we'll probably do is some kind of farm to table kind of thing. Maybe like a monthly event where we cook food from our garden in our area and, cook a vegan meal with it, because there's only one vegan restaurant out here, and it's called the Pink Elephant, and it's a green elephant or something, and it's okay. It's really overpriced, small portions, like they can get away with that for now. But I feel like I've known for a while that I'm a really good cook, and but it's just a matter of, like, doing it in a way that's fun, that's creative, that doesn't, like, take up all my time. And so I think, like, a monthly event where we just cook, like, permaculture-based foods with, like, weird shit that people aren't used to eating. And so what kind of things do I plan on cooking, growing that I haven't grown? Nut trees. Lots of nut trees. I definitely, out here we can do hazelnut, walnut, and chestnut. And so I'm going to try all those things. Chestnut blight wiped out most American chestnuts, but Chinese chestnuts can grow. So I'm definitely going to do chestnut trees. I'm going to do probably more heavily on orchard stuff. Want to grow hella blueberries, lots of apples, lots of hazelnuts. I've never grown blueberries before. I mean, we have tons of blueberry on our property and in the woods behind us, but most of them are wild, which are like small blueberries and like more of like a ground cover. But it's just crazy to just walk out into our yard. There's already like raspberry and blackberry bushes that are bigger than my backyard in Denver. And so we've just been loving going out back and eating blackberries and raspberries. But what stuff am I going to grow that I haven't grown? Specifically, the things I'm mostly looking forward to growing are sea berries, which are a bright orange plant from Siberia, which was used in Russia as a replacement for orange juice. It's a nitrogen fixer, and so you plant it near other things, and it like feeds nitrogen into the soil. And so the model I'm using for the farm, for a lot of it, will be Zach Loke's The Permaculture Market Garden, which sort of like pushes back against the small scale kind of Toby Hemingway food forest kind of stuff, and sort of adapts that approach to a more standard market garden, market farm. So I imagine that we'll be doing rows of like Siberian pea shrubs. We also have maple on our property, and we're going to try to tap some of these maple trees in the fall and see if we can't get some maple syrup. And then acorns. There's fucking acorns everywhere. In Octavia Butler, Parable of the Sower, I read about acorn bread, and then that made me really interested in what else can you do with acorn. Acorn was originally used for polenta, which is a food I love, and so I'm really interested to see what kind of things can we make with acorns. Again, that's, I don't even know if I should really be sharing that, because I feel like it's a cool idea that I don't want, I don't know, whatever, I don't care. So yeah, gonna do more with acorns. What other things we brought with us? Plants from our yard, Nenking cherry bush, and pawpaws. And just don't know what to fucking do with them, because I don't really know where I would plant these things, and I'm afraid to just put them in the ground. But pawpaws are fucking cool. Like, if you live in the Midwest or Indiana and places like that, pawpaw is a fruit that's somewhere between a banana and a mango. It's one of the oldest fruit trees around. It evolved before bees pollinated flowers and can only be pollinated by flies. It's a really underutilized crop in North America, and so I'm really interested in getting more pawpaws and trying to figure out a way to grow with them, because I know in Massachusetts people are growing pawpaws successfully, and I think we can do so here. What other Again, fucking Turkish rocket. I'm never going to give up on that. It sounds like one of the coolest plants. It's a perennial vegetable that's in the brassica family that shoots up these sort of asparagus-like shoots and has cabbage-like leaves, and then it like blossoms into these flowers, and so it's somewhere between broccoli and asparagus, and it has like a nutty flavor. There's actually a guy in Falmouth, Maine, who has a nursery that has all that shit, so I'm gonna try to make a trip down there and see if I can't cut a deal with him, and if he doesn't have too heavy of a Maine accent, I'm hoping to interview him on a podcast about perennial vegetables, because I'm just fascinated with them in general. He has everything. He also grows this tree called a tun tree, a Chinese tun tree, which is a tree that like basically dies down every year, but its leaves are cooked like a green. And so I am fucking pumped at the idea of some weird ass tree that I can use not only as a green to eat, but for compost, you know, the leaves, they fall down. Other thing that I'm really excited to grow is fucking rice. Because we have these like dry sort of marshlands on our property that are like not ponds, but like they fill up with water. Right now they're full of cattails. And so I'm excited to try to eat cattails. I'm just waiting for the buds to appear. I guess you can grill them and make pancakes. Cattails are fucking cool from what I've been reading. I haven't like gotten boots on to go in and cut some down, but I guess you can cut up the stalks like leeks, and then you can fry or you can grill the tips, and apparently that's really good. So I'm excited to eat some cattails. But then in these little swamp areas, we're gonna try to grow rice. I read in Ben Falk's book, the Resilient Homestead, about ways to grow rice in New England, and that sounds fucking amazing. So we're gonna try to grow rice out here. You know, and then, you know, for another goal for next year is to build like one of these climate battery greenhouses that we talked about on the podcast with Stephanie Sison. In these greenhouses, you know, you can grow oranges, you can grow lemons, you can grow limes. I'm going to try to grow avocados in mine. And you can just using geothermal heat and very little electricity, you can have a heated greenhouse year round. And so I'm excited to build a sort of Mediterranean greenhouse that's heated, but also kind of a hangout area in the winter, because I think winters are going to be a real big adjustment out here for us, because we were just used to so much sun. And so we want to kind of, do what we can to have a cool little weird place to hang out in the winter. And by we, I mean me. Because what they do is they have a sauna. They built a sauna and hooked it up to their greenhouse, and for like when it's really cold. So it's like you can get a sauna out of it, and also heat your plants on really, really cool nights. I'm sure I could think of a ton more things that I want to grow. Nope, I don't want to grow weed here. I grew weed in Denver. I didn't like it. I don't like having that much weed around. I'm just going to get my medical card and vape. Yeah, right now, also, there's like a plum tree on site, an apple tree. But yeah, I think nuts are what I'm mostly excited to grow. Okay. Okay, these are a bunch of questions from, I'm not saying people's names on this, I just haven't done it for anyone, but these are a lot of these from the same person, and he's like, please read and reflect on the questions before the podcast. Going to hit you up with some later today, inshallah. Wait, hold on, I will reflect on them before I answer, just out of respect. Okay, these are all great questions. Just read them, reflected a little bit. Now I'll answer. I was listening to an interview with John Anthony West, and he claimed due to geological evidence that Sphinx in Egypt is 5 to 10K older than conventionally believed. What do you think about the possibility that for thousands of years, humans have been going through peaks and valleys of advanced civilizations and enlightenment in the arts and science? I am not sure what I think. I think that in general, it's possible. However, I find it hard to believe that people, 15, 20,000 years ago achieved technology to the sophisticated levels that we're at now. I could find it easy to believe that, there's stuff in Central America and South America and Turkey, and people are constantly finding like crazy structures from 20,000 years ago, or things that were even believed to be 40,000 years ago, like temples and really things that people say would just be almost impossible to build today. Of course, a lot of the stuff people say is ancient aliens, but I feel like that takes away the agency of people who... People are fucking smart. People can figure shit out. I haven't done a lot of research on that subject, but I think it's possible. I definitely think it's possible, and I think it's possible. But I think that if we had achieved some sort of industrialized technical achievements, that there'd be a little more left around to see, because they would probably have been using steel, not stone, and things like concrete and the roads and like these things from our civilization, these will be the markers for us, 100,000 years from now. Like our steel structures will pretty much be all that remains from what I've read, but I could be wrong about that. So I think it's possible. I don't think we've gone through leaps and valleys and like that, or at least not risen to the level that we're at now. Getting away from the city, do you find yourself more relaxed and thinking less and perhaps not caring as much about politics and all the other topics that have fueled your past albums? And if so, does it feel good? And is there any guilt to not feeling as strong of emotions? And how do you reconcile those feelings? Well, I would say that I definitely find myself more relaxed being out here. I definitely do. And I wouldn't say that I don't care as much about politics, but I will say, if I'm just going to be brutally honest, and maybe this will piss some people off, but I'll just be really honest. I've really been pushing really hard, and I'm not someone who tries to take credit for the things I've done in Denver. People in Denver know what I've done. Spent tons of my money and time and doing everything I could to push forth revolutionary politics in Denver, in Colorado, and beyond. As Denver became more and more gentrified, I saw the city that I really loved just get destroyed before my eyes. I saw the place just get fucking ruined and the worst kind of people filling it. And so over the last like 3 years, I've watched all of my friends get priced out the city. And so I was able to stay because we managed to scrape up enough money to buy a house, 5 years ago. I don't fucking know. And so I just really just stopped giving a fuck. Not that I stopped giving a fuck, but I stopped organizing in Denver. And then I came to the conclusion that if only rich people can afford to live there now, I can't work like that. There's flaws in what I'm saying and there's holes in it, but I don't have time to flesh out every piece of this argument. Marginalized communities have been pushed out of Denver. They're continually being pushed out. At a certain point, I was just like, I am fucking sick of everybody flaking, of people saying they want to do something and then not doing it. And I just stopped. I stopped organizing and I stopped engaging in like these fucking tired political debates about liberalism and fucking whatever else. So part of coming out here, it is a political, for me, it's a political engagement. You know, I think of Guy Debord, who, you know, he would spend most of his time out in the mountains writing. You know, his engagement in the city, it wasn't a constant thing. It was give and take. And so, and part of, a lot of why I'm living out here is really inspired by going to Tarnac in France and seeing the way that, like, you know, radicals out there, you know, they're looking at building new forms of life, new ways of life, because the old tired models of activism and being a fucking activist firefighter chasing hashtags and, you know, doing the thing of the moment, it's not, you're just putting out fires, you're not really building capacity for the future. And these are the sorts of things that Scott Crow talks about, these are the sorts of things that It's Going Down talks about. And so I view very much what I'm doing as a political engagement. It's I'm 40 years old. You know, I have a kid now. I don't have the time to be going to every meeting and engaging in every debate and being the one who feels like they always need to push, because it's like, if you have to push too hard, then something isn't working. And there's a lot of flaws in the sort of organizing I've been doing, the sort of activism I've been doing. And so for me, I want to just sit back and kind of get back to theory, which is really what always moved me. And also, like, the idea of, like, developing new forms of life and looking at homesteading and kind of back to the land shit. It's like in the 60s, the hippies were like, you know what? All this fucking activism, we're just beating our heads up against the fucking wall. Like, how do we create the world we want to live in? And, like, they became the yippies, and that's a total failure. You know, just kind of withdrawing. And I have zero interest in withdrawing. That's why I will maintain my involvement with the Channel Zero Podcast Network and continue to work on that project and push it further. And so part of, like, taking myself out of the streets has more to do with, like, engaging more in media creation. And you know, I'm definitely reaching out to anarchists out here and anti-authoritarians in New England and trying to see what my political engagement is going to be. But I'm going to really spend the next year just sort of observing, getting to know people, showing up to things when I feel so moved. And I feel like New England really could use, I don't know, more radical approaches. It's fucking, you know, I went to the Cumberland County Jail the other day to bail someone out. We'll talk, I'm not even going to talk about that, but I was like, oh shit, this jail is totally different. They ain't got no room in this jail. Okay, it'll be interesting to see what activism and resistance could look like in a place like Maine. But again, I look at, like, I'm not interested in holding signs. I'm not interested in these things that just, like, dissipate and don't build any momentum and don't build any movement. You know, so it's really important to have intentionality. And do I feel guilty? No, I do not feel guilty. I am poor. I've been poor my whole life. I busted my ass, stuck to my guns, and ate shit to get here. And there's still a fucking ton of work. I mean, should I feel guilty for having a blown up furnace and having to figure out how to heat my house in the winter? Like, fuck. That said, though, on the other hand, I do, like, when I sit down to read at night, I'm not really looking to read some political shit right now. I am reading books about farming. I'm reading books about, like, live fermentation. I just bought that Wild Fermentation book. Like, right now I got some sourdough and kefir going. And but again, I feel like, you know, following your interests, pursuing your passions, you know, can open up new possibilities. You know, when shit pops off, I'm gonna be there. You know, when there's shit that goes down in the area, you know, I'll be there to provide whatever I have to offer. And who knows, maybe, you know, we're gonna cut down a bunch of dead trees out here. Maybe we'll build a log cabin. You know, maybe I'll learn how to build houses. You know, maybe, who knows what comes out of this, you know? And so I just trust the process. And I'm also okay with not beating my head against a wall, you know? I'm okay with not feeling like I need to, like, be leading the charge on things like anti-fascism or other stuff. Like, other people are doing that really well right now. And, like, my lane, to me, feels like, you know, it's theory, philosophy, politics, bringing it down to earth, anarchism, you know, figuring out what the intersectionality with all of that shit, with veganism and gardening, like, how can this be done in a way that builds capacity, that builds more ability for struggle. But yeah, I mean, it's complicated. These are the sorts of questions I have for other people who are doing similar things. And so I'll be, you know, check out what they have to say when I interview them, because I will be asking the same thing, because these are things that I feel about. That said, you know, I feel good to get back to my Thoreau roots and be more poetic. I mean, having a kid was really the thing that really, like, kind of brought back my humanity and made me want to be more empathetic and bring my politics more down to earth. Because I don't want to be, I know I have been saying this for years, but it's like, I don't want to be speaking in a language that is foreign to everyday people. Like, I believe that mass movements are what we're going to need at some point. But I don't have a language for talking to those people, and I don't think a lot of people do. So, you know, it's fascinating. I'm interested to see how it all pans out, but, good times. Is there still plans on a Man's Best Friend album this year? You know, I feel like the record I just put out, Let Them Eat Sand, that's what became the Man's Best Friend album. I'm actually sitting on a whole album worth of, like, white noise beats, and me and Yasmin just have to carve out the time to sit down and finish that, because that's just some cool shit right there. I'm about to release another, like, EP worth of stuff that's pretty Man's Best Friend-y, exclusively through Patreon. I'm just kind of touching it up, and I'm just started working on Nuclear Winter 3 again, because I realized I had all these, like, mixtape songs that never went anywhere. So I'm just going to kind of finish that up. But I don't know about Man's Best Friend, because I feel like, in general, that's what Let Them Eat Sand is. But maybe Let Them Eat Sand is more of a soul album that I produced and less of a Man's Best Friend album. I don't know. I don't really know where to draw that line. I mean, there's another part of me that just wants to change my name to Man's Best Friend and just invent a whole new sound. And when I think about, like, making music in this cedar barn, you know, and just having lots of space to set up crazy gear, and just make a bunch of noise and develop a whole new sound, I don't even know if that would be Man's Best Friend anymore. And so I don't really know. I don't have an answer for that. What's your view on streaming services like Spotify? I've been hearing stories how very little, if any, money reaches the artist. Well, I hate it. I hate that shit. That shit is fucking destroying art. It's basically like the clearinghouse publishing thing back in the day, where you could, like, order 15 major label albums for a penny, which I guess was fucking better back then, because you can imagine all those people got $1 million advances, and who gives a fuck if they give away a Bruce Springsteen album? Whereas giving away a soul album for a penny, you know, I'm only selling a couple couple thousand records if I'm lucky. And so you give away that soul album for a penny and or less than a penny, you know, I'm definitely not the beneficiary of that. It's the companies who own the infrastructure, and that's why things like Patreon are so vital. And I just wish that Patreon had not done what they had done to It's Going Down, and Submedia, or not, well, Submedia left on their own, but I just wish they hadn't have done that, because it taints this for me, to be blunt. But then I'm like coming around to Spotify, because I mean, if I were to guess, I think I make a couple hundred bucks a month from Spotify. But again, it's like, how much money would I be making if those weren't spot streaming sales, if those were iTunes? I don't promote Spotify. I never link my albums on Spotify. I do not manage my Spotify thing. I just push everything to Bandcamp because that's what benefits me the most. But at a certain point, I could see myself just kind of giving in and being like, you know, you can only swim against the current for so long when you're in the middle of a fucking tsunami. So that's where people are listening to music. And so I have the choice to either exempt myself from that or participate in that and get what I can. Like, I've been to shows and people have said, oh, I heard about your stuff on Spotify. And that just blows my mind. And I don't know if that's because Alpha Pup, my digital distributor, does a good job or what. But so I have mixed feelings on Spotify, the same way I do about everything else. In a way, I feel like places like YouTube are more honest, because like, you're seeing an ad and, you know, there's no pretense, where people aren't paying $10 a month with like some feeling that they're like supporting art or something. You shouldn't be able to have every album in the world for $10 a month. It's not sustainable. But again, I see like, that's just not the battle I'm choosing to fight these days. So I just promote my Bandcamp, promote my Patreon, play shows when it makes sense. Fuck it. Do you have any alien or shape-shifting stories or a clairvoyant experience? I've definitely seen things that look like UFOs. But, you know, they were probably drones now when I think back on it. You know, it was like back in the late 90s, I saw things flying around in the desert in New Mexico. But I think that those were drones. Or it's likely that they were drones. And do I have clairvoyant experience? I kind of do. One time I was playing... This is stupid. This is really a banal clairvoyant experience. But I was... it was like when I was in fourth grade or third grade and I was playing Zelda. I had just beat the game, and then you go into like the second world where like all the dungeons are changed and they're hidden. And I had this dream that I went into a forest, and this endless forest maze thing, and burned down this like one tree, and under the tree there was stairs and a dungeon. And when I woke up the next morning, I went to this like weird maze forest and burned down that one tree, and then there was the dungeon to level 7, and that always fucked me up. But who knows, maybe I saw it somewhere. I know I didn't, but maybe I did and just didn't realize it. You know, my mom was really big into like Edgar Cayce psychics kind of stuff, so if you listen to my older music, you can kind of hear some of that new agey sort of psychic stuff. And I definitely, you know, used to listen to Art Bell and, you know, tried to, like, bought a book on, like, remote viewing. And when I did it, it really fucked me up. I kind of had what some people would describe as a sort of schizophrenic breakdown. And so I just stopped fucking with all that kind of shit, because... It doesn't serve me. But who knows, maybe, you know, it's been, the last month has been crazy. So who knows, maybe I'll start meditating, but I always say that and I never want to, because it's just, I just don't like that kind of shit. I'm starting to see the wisdom in smaller... So here's another question. I'm starting to see the wisdom in smaller communities or tribes, and this may be the healthiest social structure for humans. As a whole, have you reflected on what alienation of a person living in the suburbs who never talks to their neighbors and orders everything online and the disconnect that condition brings to a person? I was listening to an interview, and the person had a theory that this condition of being disconnected may be a cause of why people commit mass shootings. And another point, that if you live in a small town and you see someone suffering, you will help them, but you could walk out your door in San Francisco, see someone pass out on the sidewalk, and walk right past them. Yeah, I mean, you know the saying, it takes a village. We definitely talked about this in my last podcast with Nancy Munson about, you know, early childhood education, and I tend to agree. And, you know, it even reminds me of, like, the Pete Seeger quote, like, the world will not be saved by big things, but, small things. And I do think that, like, small groups of people living and working together, is potentially better than giant cities, mega civilizations. There are a lot of arguments that people have made about how, quote unquote, hunter scavengers lived versus like the advent of civilization, and how giant cities necessitated a state, petroleum-based agriculture, laws, courts, cops, etc. Whereas, you know, tiny groups of smaller groups of people living together, you know, people are more likely to find affinity with each other. People are more likely to have consensus. Whereas if you have 100,000 people, people's ability to sort of experiment and live differently seem to be a little bit limited. But again, I've never lived in a small intentional community. I can only point back to points in my life when I had tight-knit communities of 10 to 30 people, who I was constantly interacting with, working with, collaborating with. That tends to be when I was the happiest, maybe not the healthiest, because I was a little fucked up at times, but definitely the happiest and most constructive. So it really, you know, I think that is true. And as far as the alienation and mass killing stuff, I do believe that. I think that that is right on. That's what Franco Berardi talks about in his book, Heroes. And we did an interview on that. I highly suggest people go back and listen to that, because, you know, that's basically what he is saying in his interview, is that alienation is the cause of the mass killings. Because if you go back and you look at, I mean, or one leading cause, you know, you can't point to one simple thing and say, oh, it's this. But if you go back and listen to that interview, you know, that's what he talks about. And if you look at the things that these people post online, these like mass killers, these school shooters, they're always alienated white men who can't live up to the patriarchy, can't live up to the crazy weights and stresses that society puts on people. And so, you know, a lot of people have said that that's toxic masculinity. I think that may be too simplistic. I think there's a lot of other things going on there. But yeah, and again, I, you know, spoke on this in other parts of this interview, but from what I've seen from like smaller intentional communities, that is the way to be. I think that is a healthier way to live. And there's also an argument to be made that, there's more of like a kind of insurrectionary anarchist argument that, you know, if you wait for the whole world to catch up with you, you know, the world might burn. Whereas if you just get together with a bunch of people who feel the same and want to do the same things and want to build on their own, you know, you have a much more chance of developing new ways of being and new new creative responses to things. So yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely worth trying. And in the end, it's like whatever works for you. Like, actually, for the way I live, none of that shit works for me. I don't want to live in a commune with, you know, 15 of my best friends right now. I really like my privacy, and so I'm thinking more like, how can I federate with a bunch of people who want to develop systems of mutual aid and solidarity and things like that. But, you know, for whatever, depends on where you're at in your life and, you know, how you thrive.
Last question. Have you read Desert? Do you have any, have I read Desert? Have I read Desert? That's one of my favorite and most influential books. In fact, on Soul and DJ Pain 1, Pattern of Life EP, we have a song called Desert. If you read Nihilismo, the Nihilismo Reader, there's an excerpt from Desert on there. And it has influenced me greatly. And it has influenced me in many ways in this move. I could definitely trace a line from Desert to projects like Tarnak and the writings of the Invisible Committee. Have you read Desert? Do you have any thoughts on that essay or environmental nihilism in general? Well, I don't think that that's nihilism. I know some people call that nihilism, but I don't find their approach to be nihilistic. To me, they're on some build the commune shit. They're on some, you know, all of your gestures will amount to nothing. You know, global warming is a done deal. And like, you know, blocking pipelines and, you know, doing all this shit that, you know, these people have been doing this for decades, you know, a decade or more. And like, they realized like all they got from it was like felonies and they, you know, you look at the fucking science and it's like, no, this is happening. So what are you going to do about it? And to me, that is not like, that is not nihilist. I mean, maybe pessimistic. I don't know if it's right. It's, to me, it feels right. To be honest, I agree with it. I certainly wouldn't, you know, but like fighting and resisting, you know, we can't not fight and resist. Like, we have to resist. It just, you know, but again, it's like, I feel like we have to go through all of those steps and all those points to get to sharpen our politics. And so, you know, that, and from Desert, I mean, well, first of all, not only have I read Desert, but I'm supposed to be making an audiobook of Desert with my homies from Occupied Southwest Distro. That project was supposed to get done a month ago. Neither of us have really done anything. And that's something I really intend to do right now. And whether or not, like, I fully agree with what is written in Desert, you know, it's a sucker for language and books like that. And I highly recommend people read it. But so, yeah, do I... So, yeah, so my thoughts on it are, like, they're basically saying, like, yo, the, you know, the world is ending. It's fucking, we're living through it. And, like, we can fight wars that have already been lost, or we can prepare for the wars for the future. And that's why when asked previously how I feel about what I'm doing out here, I feel like it's a political intervention. It's an engagement. And yeah, and that's kind of what I'm drawing on. How do you view the role of the gardener, farmer, permaculturist in the future as governments and rich seek to control the inhabitable landscapes? Well, I think that I don't necessarily know if that's going to be what happens. If I were to... You know, I know it's like cliche, but if I were to look at the future, I see governments like trying to gain more control, but losing ground. And so I look at like what happened in Rojava and Chiapas, and I view that as like the model for the future, to be honest. I think that the United States
if it continues on the path it's on, it's highly likely that its power will just weaken and weaken and weaken to the point where, you know, people can live more autonomously. And when you have armed self-defense and people's, you know, when you've increased people's quote-unquote resilience and people's ability to survive and develop the tools to survive, to live without the state, to learn to depend on each other, developing systems of mutual aid, resilience, spreading the skills, but not doing it in a bourgeois way, doing it in a way that, like, increases capacity for everyone, that to me is the future, and that's what I'm doing. And so I don't think it's nihilist. I mean, I struggle with nihilism, and so maybe it is nihilism, and I just don't want to admit it. But yeah, I love that book. It really inspired me and influenced me, and I think people should check it out. But you know, holla at me next month. Maybe I'll drop it maybe we'll drop it soon and finish it up. Maybe this was just the prod I needed to finish that, because it shouldn't take too long. But the role of the permaculturist, you know, that's the whole, again, there's a whole bunch of problems with permaculture. But the whole idea of permaculture is like creating systems that function without the need of, like, inputs of industrial society. And that is going to be key to surviving the future. I mean, a lot of these things people have already been doing for thousands of years. If you look at, like, the steps of Japan, like the crazy rice paddies on mountains, you know, the way that people have been building, you know, food forests in places like Indonesia, or old farming methods of the ancient Incas and the Mayans, and there's a lot of, and I mean, shit, fucking Native Americans here in North America, or I should say indigenous people of North America, you know, cultivated everything that we see around us, and, you know, because they were pushed off their land and victims of a genocide, much of the wild in North America has fallen to the wayside and been overtaken by weeds. But they cultivated forests, you know, with, like, medicinal plants, edible plants, you know, and, like, pilgrims would come, or settlers would come and say, oh, it's all wild, these people don't know how to grow food. But it's like there was food all around them. The settlers just couldn't see it. So I think Desert is actually a critical text that people should read. I'm glad to end on that note. So that's the role. That's the role of the permaculture, is to develop systems that can withstand the next 100 years, which are going to be fucked. So, all right. Well, hey, everyone. Thanks for your questions. Really appreciate the questions, and tune in next month for some awesome shit. Peace.
Yeah, 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 yeah. This is M1, M-A-1, M-A de la gente, comprende, entiende, you feel me? I'm one half of Dead Prez, to tell it like it is. Everything is political rap duo. Here holding my middle finger up to imperialism worldwide. And you in tune right now to the rebel beat.
The Rebel Beat is a monthly podcast of radical political music across different genres and across different continents. It's the mixtape to a riot against police brutality. It's your nightly newscast set to bass and beats. It's protest anthems from Hong Kong to Istanbul to Ferguson to Montreal. Give it a listen at rebelbeatradio.com or subscribe today on all your favorite podcast platforms.